Welcome to this special iJournal Club audio program focused on important clinical research in the management of patients with metastatic squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love, and for this program, I met with Dr. Shirish Gadgil, and to begin, he talked about recent advances in the treatment of patients with non-small cell lung cancer.
What I would say is that the best evidence, I think, of the changes that have occurred in the management of particularly, I would say, advanced non-small cell lung cancer is the fact that the American Cancer Society released data of the significant decline in cancer mortality. And it appears, according to the data release, that it was primarily driven by the decrease in mortality in lung cancer. It is very clear, especially with the sudden decline. So specifically, they mentioned there was a 5% decline in mortality in men and 4% in women between 2016 and 2017. And that strongly suggests that this decline, to at least some degree, is driven by the fact that our treatments have improved. Because I don't think we are necessarily detecting, particularly in that short period of time, more lung cancers in the early stage that mortality would decline. Yes, there is more uptake of screening. And so that's what even the American Cancer Society sort of commentary suggested, that this may be driven by the new treatments. And frankly, for somebody who is now doing for 20 years, the two major advances is identification of targetable alterations and, of course, the introduction of immunotherapy, and very specifically, the PD-1 and PD-L1 directed therapy. So I can tell you that from an era where pulmonologists wondered, was I sort of crazy to go into thoracic oncology, to now it being the field where there has been most advances, is truly gratifying.
You know, I think a lot about the fellows and people who are just coming into the field really have no idea how quickly, you know, we've been doing lung cancer meetings, satellites at ASCO for like 10, 15 years now. And I looked at the agenda for 2014, which is when your lady presented, and the word checkpoint inhibitors was not in the agenda 5 years ago. We did not even talk about it at that meeting. And now, well, we'll talk about where we are today. Maybe we can start out with this patient, and then we're going to move from her into a bunch of papers that relate to, you know, the management of metastatic squamous cell. But I see she presented in 2014, 72 years old. How did she present? You saw her at that time?
Yeah. So she actually came for a second opinion. She was diagnosed in January. And I can tell you that as I was preparing this case to send it to you, it was truly great to now, it's been 6 years since she was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Even now, I get surprised by the fact that, you know, it's been 6 years since diagnosis. And I distinctly remember, because that was the first patient that we enrolled at our site in KEYNOTE-21. And I can also say that it was probably among the first patients. I don't think it was the first patient on that trial. A very brief background to that was that clearly by then we had seen that checkpoint inhibitors were going to be beneficial, particularly in the second line setting in non-small cell lung cancer. And this was among the first trials to evaluate them in frontline setting. And I can tell you very frankly that there were very good and respected immune experts who were not very convinced that combining checkpoint inhibitors with chemotherapy necessarily makes sense. And so it was against this background that we initiated this study and we participated in this study. And I distinctly remember this lady was fairly symptomatic. She had cough, shortness of breath. She also had some discomfort in the left chest that I was not sure was it only just from cough. She also had rib metastases. And so we enrolled her on the study. And the way the study was that they had multiple arms, and the arm she went on was carboplatin, paclitaxel, and pembrolizumab. So this was a phase 1 study with a plan to do dose expansion. So she was among the first patients enrolled on the combination of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and pembrolizumab. I will say that during the first 4 cycles, she did appear to have more side effects than what I'm normally seeing with carboplatin and paclitaxel. Nothing terribly worse, but I felt that the fatigue was worse. Some of nausea symptoms were worse. And after four cycles, the study, you know, there was planned discontinuation of chemotherapy. She had a very good response. And in fact, most of her symptoms during those four cycles were more related to the treatment than to the cancer. What was to me amazing is I had seen the response, and her response, clearly she had met PR by RECIST criteria. But she, as we were doing the maintenance pembrolizumab, looked much better. And I can tell you, for no specific reason, in October, so the lady started in February of 2014, and we had a baseline PET scan on her. And I was curious, and I will admit that this was done not so much for clinical management as much for curiosity as to how her bones were responding, because sometimes assessing bones can be a challenging thing on CT scan. And I can tell you that PET scan that we obtained in October 2014 shows almost no metabolic uptake in any of the lesions. In fact, none of the bone lesions were positive, maybe a slight uptake in the lymph nodes. So she, as per protocol, got treatment for 2 years. And so she completed therapy in January of 2016. I can tell you now this, we do it more and more routinely, but in January of 2016, both she and I were somewhat nervous about discontinuing treatment, you know, in a stage four patient, even though the scans looked wonderful. I will admit that I have now since then, so in 2017, I changed institutions. So I no longer have the privilege of taking care of her, but I have kept sort of following her case with the colleagues of mine in my previous institution. And she's still doing well, and her scans have not changed. And now we have these, a small number, but a growing number of patients that have received these checkpoint inhibitors, either with chemotherapy or single agent in the frontline setting. And we are just monitoring them. I have sort of started increasing the frequency of the scans I get. Initially, it was every 3 months. In one patient now, I've even gone up to 6 months. Don't know what this patient's outcome is going to be. It's very difficult to think of the cure word in stage four lung cancer, but you know, it's a tantalizing prospect, let's say, but we need longer follow-up.
Was she an ex-smoker?
Yeah, she had stopped smoking just a few months before. I mean, actually, to be very frank, at the time of diagnosis. So yes, she was a heavy smoker.
Interesting. So maybe we can use that just as a base and kind of take off from there and talk a little bit about where we are today, what clinical research information we've received and we have to deal with right now in metastatic non-small cell, particularly metastatic squamous cell. And you were involved with two papers that were review articles, one focusing on pembrolizumab and the other focusing on pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy. Can you talk a little bit about some of the key points that you and your co-authors were trying to make?
So I think that treatment for non-small cell lung cancer, more so in adenocarcinoma, but also in squamous cell lung cancer, has clearly evolved from just a platinum-based doublet. Of course, in the past, we used to be certain that we used histology-driven platinum-based doublet, to now ensuring, particularly in adenocarcinomas, doing molecular analysis and PD-L1 assessment, and in squamous cell, definitely PD-L1 assessment, though I will say that more and more I've started getting, in at least selective squamous cell lung cancer patients, even frontline molecular analysis. But the PD-L1 status, at least right now, seems to be driving therapy, particularly in squamous cell lung cancer. So if a patient's PD-L1 is above 50%, then in those patients, I'll consider pembrolizumab. Whereas in patients who are below 50%, usually they would be candidates for chemotherapy and pembrolizumab. Now, for the patients above 50%, I have considered chemotherapy and pembrolizumab instead of just single agent pembrolizumab. And that is because if I believe that the patient needs a quicker response because of higher tumor burden, then I would consider doing chemotherapy and pembrolizumab, because the data from KEYNOTE-407, which was the squamous cell study of chemo plus pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy alone, and KEYNOTE-24, which was single agent pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy in both histologies, suggests that the response rate may be higher with chemotherapy and pembrolizumab versus pembrolizumab alone. And so if I feel that the patient needs a quicker response, patient is more symptomatic, patient has a higher tumor burden, I'd consider chemotherapy and pembrolizumab. In squamous cell, of course, we continue chemotherapy up to a usually four, occasionally up to six cycles, and after which I discontinue chemotherapy and just maintain them on pembrolizumab. And of course, if they were getting pembrolizumab only right from the beginning, I continue that. I usually will stop treatment at 2 years. I tend to follow the studies as they were conducted. I will admit it's a discussion, and frankly, I start that discussion at least 6 months in advance as to, you know, one of the thoughts is to stop the treatment because that's how the studies were conducted. But I can tell you there are patients' sort of responses to that discussion is very different. Some patients are very happy. They are done with the every 3 week visit and, you know, like to see me only every 3 months. Whereas there are other patients who are very nervous and very anxious. And so I distinctly remember a different patient, adenocarcinoma patient who had chemoradiation for stage 3 disease, very young patient, only 37 years old, had HER2 mutation actually and PD-L1 high. And within 6 months of completing chemotherapy and radiation, at that time we were not doing consolidation durvalumab because that data was not available. So within 6 months, the patient progressed. And because his PD-L1 was high, we started him on pembrolizumab. That was in September of 2016. And he continues on pembrolizumab because he's extremely reluctant, having progressed within 6 months after chemoradiation, to discontinue pembrolizumab. So it's a discussion, but if the patient, which some patients do say, what would you do, doctor? I have tended to stop them at 2 years.
So maybe we can talk a little bit about choice of regimen, choice of PD-1 agent, and choice of chemotherapy and first-line therapy of metastatic squamous. And maybe kind of think back to when this 72-year-old lady presented. Maybe you can just think about a patient like her presenting again today, metastatic squamous cell, PD-L1 low and PD-L1 high, how you might have approached her being somewhat symptomatic.
So I think in this patient, if she had presented today, there's a reasonable chance that I would have started her on chemotherapy along with pembrolizumab, even if the PD-L1 was high. Now, I will say there is some data to suggest that if the PD-L1 is 95%, 100%, that the probability of benefit is greater. It's retrospective data, it is single institution data, and so I always view that with level of caution. In my practice, I've not routinely been swayed one way or the other based on the PD-L1 expression level as to whether I would use chemotherapy or not. I've usually looked at the patient's symptomatic status and the tumor burden. So in this lady, based on the symptoms that she had, I think I would have leaned towards doing chemotherapy. Depending upon what insurance will cover, I have usually considered using carboplatin, nab-paclitaxel. The use of steroids may be a little bit less, though we do have to use steroids with carboplatin, though I'm very comfortable using carboplatin, paclitaxel. The only switch I make, and this is my personal choice, I don't do paclitaxel every 3 weeks. So what I do is I give carboplatin every 3 weeks, pembrolizumab, of course, every 3 weeks. But the paclitaxel, I do about 90 milligram per meter square day 1, day 8. So there was a study done about 8 years ago, French study, first author Quah, published in Lancet, that looked at the weekly paclitaxel plus carboplatin in elderly patients. And in that study, the combination was reasonably well tolerated and showed superiority compared to single agent. Until then, we had never shown that doublet chemotherapy was better in elderly patients, elderly being defined as more than 75. So I started using that regimen in my elderly patients, and I've really found that when you use paclitaxel on a weekly basis instead of doing the carboplatin paclitaxel every 3 weeks, that patients tolerate it better. They don't seem to have as much myalgias, as much neuropathy, and just manage to get through the 4 cycles better with the weekly paclitaxel. So that's a variation that was not, I want to be clear, not the dosing or schedule used in 407. It was the standard paclitaxel every 3 weeks of 200 milligram per meter square.
So paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel?
So I prefer to use nab-paclitaxel, but, you know, some insurances will insist on paclitaxel. And to me, that's a minor issue, so I have no hesitation in using paclitaxel.
What data do we have from other checkpoint inhibitors in metastatic squamous?
So the other major frontline study that is across histologies, of course, the CheckMate 227, it was a phase 3 study, large study, has gone through a data release at various time points. Broadly speaking, the study had two different sort of sub-studies. One was in PD-L1 positive patients, one was in PD-L1 negative patients.
Now, which agent?
So in the PD-L1 positive, the study was randomized to chemotherapy as the standard arm, single agent nivolumab versus nivolumab plus ipilimumab. And in PD-L1 negative patients, the patients were randomized to nivolumab, ipilimumab, chemotherapy alone, and chemotherapy plus nivolumab. And at last year's ESMO, Dr. Peters presented the data, and then subsequently Dr. Hellman published it in the New England Journal of Medicine, that in patients above 1%, nivolumab plus ipilimumab combination provided a survival advantage compared to chemotherapy alone, and this was across histology. However, when you look at the subsets of that data, and again, that is subset analysis, the primary driver of that survival benefit was patients whose PD-L1 was 50% or greater. There was no survival advantage in patients between 1 and 49%. And when you look at the survival benefit observed, it does not seem any different than what we have seen with pembrolizumab in Keynote 24 or Keynote 42. So it is not clear that in that particular population, the nivolumab-ipilimumab combination, now this is across trial comparisons, but nivolumab-ipilimumab combination necessarily provides better benefit than pembrolizumab alone. Interestingly, there is an ongoing study of pembrolizumab with or without ipilimumab in PD-L1 high patients, and it would be interesting to see what that study shows. What was also interesting is in the PD-L1 negative, ipilimumab-nivolumab combination was found to be better than chemotherapy. So we do have data now, it's not yet FDA approved, but we do have a data of another combination regimen of nivolumab and ipilimumab that has shown a survival advantage to chemotherapy. However, I'm not sure at the present time that it is necessarily better than chemotherapy and pembrolizumab or pembrolizumab alone in PD-L1 high patients.
What about atezolizumab?
Yes, so again at ESMO last year, we have now data that atezolizumab has shown a survival advantage compared to chemotherapy in PD-L1 high. Now, the way they defined PD-L1 high was a little different than what we are used to. So generally, when we test for PD-L1, it is in tumor cells, whereas in the atezolizumab trials, the PD-L1 was assessed both in the tumor cells and in the infiltrating inflammatory cells. So they look at both together. And so the PD-L1 high definition is a little different. Though they did present data, the survival advantage persisted even if they had looked at the PD-L1 according to the standard 22C3 DACO. But so we have now another single agent checkpoint inhibitor that has shown a survival advantage. Interestingly, the first PD-L1 agent that in the frontline setting has shown a survival advantage. And that study was also across histology. Now, again, not yet FDA approved, but likely we'll have 2-3 different options that don't include chemotherapy for PD-L1 high patients. But I think that at the present time, at least in PD-L1 low and negative, both for adenocarcinoma and squamous cell lung cancers, I would lean towards doing chemotherapy and pembrolizumab.
So the last thing I want to ask you about before we get into second line and beyond and new approaches is the paper that you had in anti-cancer research, Cancer Site and Adverse Events Induced by Immune Checkpoint Inhibitors. Can you talk a little bit about what you looked at there and what was seen and what you think it means?
So this was a very good effort by my colleagues at Karmanos, where they did a very detailed retrospective review of all the patients who had received checkpoint inhibitors across different tumor types. And I think what they were looking for is not just to find out, you know, what immune-related adverse events did these patients develop, but was there any increased probability of certain events based on the tumor type they had. So it appears that, for example, in head and neck cancer and in thyroid cancer patients, that they saw more hypothyroidism. Now, how much that had to do with prior radiation therapy is difficult to know. But I think it's a note of caution that in these patients particularly, I mean, I think thyroid function needs to be checked in every patient who gets a checkpoint inhibitor. But I think that particularly in these patients, we may be even more vigilant about these toxicities. And the other issue, which was not surprising, that the fatality from pneumonitis was greater in lung cancer patients as compared to pneumonitis occur in other tumor types. And again, I don't think it's surprising because these patients tend to be chronic smokers and may have associated COPD or may have had received radiation and therefore may already have lung injury, in that their ability to tolerate pneumonitis may be impaired. So I think what we found is there may be some correlation to the tumor and the type of immune adverse events that the patients may be susceptible to.
Yeah, you hear people talking about that sort of anecdotally, but I was really interested to see you actually had a series that was looking at it. So let's move on now and talk about, you know, another issue. You know, squamous cell certainly hasn't got the kind of attention that non-squamous has in terms of targeted therapy. But I was really interested by, not too long ago, there was a paper that came out in JAMA Oncology, and in particular the editorial there that I wanted to ask you about and kind of see where that fits in, not just in lung cancer, but the whole realm of HER2 alterations, shall we say. We hear it being discussed now in colon cancer, and of course for a long time now in breast cancer. Can you kind of begin by talking a little bit about the LUX-Lung-8 trial, what it looked at, and sort of the subsequent studies that have been done on those patients, and kind of what the bottom line is in terms of what was found?
The first thing I would like to say is that HER2 alterations may also be seen in squamous cell lung cancer, and this is something that may not be as well appreciated as I believe it should be. And if I can sort of take a step back slightly, you know, there was hope and expectation that, similar to adenocarcinoma, where we have these pie charts of EGFR and ALK and ROS1, and we give directed targeted therapy and see clinical benefit, that we will have a similar sort of a effort in squamous cell lung cancer, where we can identify genetically altered subsets and then use drugs that target those genetic alterations. I think in squamous cell lung cancer, and this was first suggested by the TCGA analysis of over 100 squamous cell cancers, almost 200 rather, these were early stage cancers where they did a very detailed genomic analysis and found a variety of alterations. And I think what is clear is squamous cell tends to be a lot more genomically altered cancer as compared to, say, I would say adenocarcinomas. Now, adenocarcinomas tend to occur in never smokers. And of course, adenocarcinomas that occur in smokers also tend to be genomically much more altered than, say, in never smokers. And so I think it was a little simplistic in a sense for us to think that we identify a genetic alteration and we can target it, because invariably these tumors are dependent on multiple pathways and multiple gene alterations. So to some degree, our initial efforts have not yielded the same benefit as we have seen in adenocarcinomas. But I think that this data is going to be extremely important, because as we learn more about these genomic subgroups, and similar to, say, lymphoma and breast cancer, genomically now, according to the TCGA, squamous cell lung cancers can be divided into sort of a classical type, basal type, a primitive type, and a secretory type. And there are specific genetic alterations or specific features, not just genetically, but even in terms of its tumor metabolism, that is different. And I think as we learn more details about such genomic subtypes, I think we can develop more smarter treatments. So LUX-Lung-8 was a study that looked at afatinib versus erlotinib. Many of us, particularly the junior oncologist may not know that erlotinib, when it was first introduced, we had no knowledge of EGFR mutations. The EGFR story actually started in the 60s. It was recognized as a commonly expressed protein on many epithelial cancers, and that's what triggered the whole idea of targeting this receptor, first with monoclonal antibodies and subsequently with TKIs. And so EGFR TKIs such as erlotinib were used much more broadly in the past. And so if somebody now looks at the study, they would wonder why erlotinib, which no longer has approval beyond EGFR mutation positive lung cancer patients, at least in the US, was the sort of the standard arm. But at that time it was used. What is also interesting is that if one looks at particularly chemotherapy and EGFR monoclonal antibodies, both nacitumumab and cetuximab, consistently there is a small but definite benefit observed in these studies. Now, overall, it was not felt to be meaningful, but scientifically, it raised the possibility that targeting EGFR pathway may have relevance in squamous cell lung cancer patients. And so against that background, this study was evaluated because afatinib, at least preclinically, is felt to be a more potent inhibitor, not just of mutant EGFR, but wild-type EGFR. And so the hope was that we would see better benefit. And the results showed that there was improvement both in progression-free survival and overall survival. Now, admittedly, the benefit was modest with hazard ratios approximately 0.82 to 0.83. And so there was a desire to see if there was a population that was particularly going to benefit with afatinib over erlotinib. And so one of the efforts was to do next-generation sequencing. So the study was about 800 patients, and the study was able to do NGS testing in approximately 250 patients. And what it found was one of the areas of interest in the NGS testing was to see if alterations in the EGFR family of receptors, so not just in EGFR1 receptor, but EGFR family of receptors correlated with outcomes. And what they found was that in the tumors they could analyze, so approximately 250-odd tumors, about 21% or 53 tumors had alterations in the EGFR family of receptors. And what they found that the benefit, both in terms of PFS and OS, appeared to be better in patients whose tumors had these alterations with afatinib compared to erlotinib. Whereas when it came to erlotinib, there didn't appear to be a difference whether these alterations were present or not. And what was striking was that even though only 12 patients, so one needs to view this data with a high level of caution, but 12 patients had HER2 mutations. These patients had the best outcome with afatinib as compared to erlotinib, suggesting that yes, afatinib based on Luxung-8, and it is approved in squamous cell lung cancer patients, could be an option in subsequent lines of therapy. I would prefer in the second line still to use either docetaxel or docetaxel combined with ramucirumab. But in subsequent lines, third or fourth line, it is definitely a consideration, particularly if NGS has been performed and an alteration in the EGFR family of receptors has been identified. So clearly there appears to be a role, though I would say a limited and more in the subsequent lines of therapy.
So just from my naive point of view, trying to just understand this and also keeping in mind all these other things we're hearing in other cancers, you know, for example, we've been hearing a lot about neratinib in breast cancer. Now, that's mainly HER2 amplified, but then I've heard it talk about with mutations. So I kind of have that in mind. You know, again, colorectal cancer, you see amplification, they're using, you know, pertuzumab, trastuzumab. So I don't know whether or not we're kind of looking at the same animal from different points of view, but can you, you know, somebody's maybe not that familiar with all the biology involved here, kind of paint a picture about how not only the biology, what the receptor is, but how these different agents affect the tumors who have these alterations.
So I completely agree that HER2 alterations is clearly a sort of a growing field, if I can say, when you look across oncology. When it comes to lung cancer, studies have been done with HER2-directed therapies, and patients have been selected with variety of biomarkers. They've been selected by IHC expression, which is routine in breast and gastric cancer, to identify patients who would benefit from drugs like trastuzumab. But patients have also been tested for HER2 mutations and HER2 amplification. It does appear that presence of HER2 mutation is a driver, because there's clear evidence that if you're able to inhibit HER2, you see clinical benefit. Now, the data in patients with HER2 amplification is a bit limited, and how significant of a driver if you do identify HER2 amplification is a bit unclear. And at the present time, though the data is limited, I think in non-small cell lung cancer, IHC expression may not have a relevance in selecting patients for therapy. So what data do we have for HER2-directed treatments? Now, before I go there, I would say that the rate is about 1% to 2% for HER2 mutations, and about HER2 amplification is approximately the same. And there are clearly patients who have both HER2 mutation and HER2 amplification.
Could I just clarify that? Because, you know, that graph that you just talked about, if I understood it correctly, said that at least in this study, the 250 people were studied, the incidence of alterations was like 20%. So is that, that's everything?
That's correct. So it included both mutations, though the patients they identified where they saw the benefit was in the LuxLung-8 was essentially HER2 mutation that showed a significant
benefit.
But all
I'm saying is, I think it was 20% of the population, right?
So overall rate of alterations in EGFR family of receptors was 20%, of which only 12. So I would say approximately only 2% or so was HER2 mutations.
Now, 2% of squamous.
Correct.
So first of all, I'll say that's more than NTRK.
Correct. Now, I will say that that's a little bit higher than other series that I've shown. Clearly, HER2 mutations are more common in adenocarcinomas than squamous. But I think the point is well taken that it is occurs enough that at least some of these squamous cell patients may benefit from such HER2-directed therapy, if not actually be considered for clinical trials that are looking at HER2-directed therapy. And I think we have more and more data that is suggesting that there could be benefit. So TKIs clearly were first evaluated. You mentioned neratinib. So there was a study of neratinib where the response rate was limited. So one of the problems with all the HER2 studies in lung cancer is that the N, or the number of patients in these studies, are extremely small. They range from like 15 to 30 patients. And so making a lot of sort of conclusions is challenging. The second point is that you're using TKIs in the second, third line setting. We know that even with EGFR and ALK drugs, when you use them after chemotherapy or multiple lines of therapy, the response rate is not the same when you use it as frontline therapy. But nonetheless, with neratinib, only one of 26 patients responded. When you look at afatinib or dacometinib, the response rate ranges anywhere from 7 to 20%. Now, what is interesting is there is some data to suggest that the type of HER2 mutation may matter. So as we are familiar with EGFR, we have exon 19, exon 21 mutation, and then, of course, exon 20 mutations. And we know that other TKIs work differently based on the type of, even between 19 and 21, there's data to suggest that the PFS may be longer in exon 19 mutation. So again, when it comes to HER2, predominantly these mutations are in exon 20. But there are non-exon 20 mutations as well, and there's data to suggest that specific exon 20 mutations may be more sensitive to these TKIs. And I think this needs to be better studied to sort of try and direct these treatments to the right patient. It is possible that with certain HER2 mutations, we may not see a clinical benefit with these drugs. Another group of drugs that is being looked at is the antibody drug conjugates. So both T-DM1 and now I prefer to call it DS-8201. It is a antibody drug conjugate that got approval in breast cancer patients.
Right. Well, we did a symposium in San Antonio on HER2 positive disease. And of course, we talked about that agent. I was going to ask you about it, because the fascinating thing, of course, is in breast cancer, you see responses in HER2-low, IHC 1 and 2 plus. So do we know anything about it in lung cancer?
Yep. So there was sort of a phase 1 study conducted in non-small cell lung cancer patients, and they looked at both IHC positive and mutation positive. Now, the numbers are, again, very small. We only have 11 patients, and almost all of the patients had HER2 mutation positive disease. But they saw a 72% response rate with a median progression-free survival of 14 months. And they are currently doing a study where they're looking at both HER2 mutation positive and HER2 IHC positive, two different cohorts. If you're HER2 mutation positive, irrespective of what your HER2 IHC is, you get enrolled in the HER2 mutation positive cohort. And what I can say is that the HER2 mutation cohort, after the first interim analysis, has opened up again. I don't know the data, so I suspect that the interim analysis suggested that there was sufficient activity to continue enrollment. Right now, the HER2 IHC is on hold after going through the interim analysis, so we'll see. T-DM1 also showed a response rate of 44%, and overall, these antibody-drug conjugates, interestingly, in HER2 mutation-positive lung cancer patients are showing what appear to be, again, numbers are very small, but appear to be showing higher and maybe more sustained benefit than the TKIs.
What I'd be really interested in is whether objective responses have been observed with either one of those antibody drug conjugates in lung cancer.
Yes, so with the DS8201 and with T-DM1. So in T-DM1, in an 18-patient study published by Dr. Bob Lee from Memorial Sloan Kettering and JCO, of the 18 patients, 8 had objective response. Median PFS was 5 months. And in the DS8201, again, only 11 patients. The numbers are very small, so we'll need more data before we can sort of be certain about these results. But 72% objective response rate with the median progression-free survival of 14 months. So definitely there's a great deal of promise with these drugs. And to some degree, what is very interesting, having used both these drugs, that my sense, and again, this is just sense, is that these drugs appear to be somewhat, yes, they're intravenous and they're not oral. So there's a little bit of inconvenience in that regard. But the drugs appear to be quite well tolerated, whereas the TKIs that we tend to use for HER2 are not always easy on the patients. So I think it will be really interesting to see how the results of these drugs pan out in the future.
Yeah, really interesting, particularly because they're actually out on the market. So theoretically, maybe they could be accessed.
I will say that if I had a HER2 mutation positive patient today, whether it's adenocarcinoma or squamous, and for some reason I can't access a clinical trial, I would at least try to get T-DM1. I would say even before the TKIs. Again, whether insurance will cover or not, I don't know, but it's something that I would at least try to get.
So as you mentioned, though, afatinib is approved right now in metastatic squamous, you know, without EGFR mutation. So, and you mentioned the issue with tolerability. And I was curious because, again, at that San Antonio meeting, when we were talking about neratinib, of course, it was a post-adjuvant situation, but they were talking about some of the work that's been done to decrease toxicity with neratinib. There was this so-called control study. They tried lowering the dose. They did preemptive medications for diarrhea. And, you know, if you take a look at afatinib in kind of a similar way, I mean, it seems sort of similar clinically. Are those kind of strategies something you would use in a patient on afatinib?
Absolutely. The thing that is still, I think, and again, I need to look at the breast cancer data to sort of educate myself, but one concern I have is, so I've done a lot of interventions when I use drugs like afatinib or some of the newer sort of exon 20 drugs. But what I feel is that patients just have a very persistent sort of low-grade toxicity that can't be called significant, but is clearly bothersome to the overall quality of life. The other thing that I think, in again, my personal opinion, is underreported is that the diarrhea, even though it may be controlled, the patients do have intermittent diarrhea or certain foods trigger the diarrhea. And what I have seen is some of these patients develop weight loss. And that happens over a long period of time, you know, maybe 2-3 months, and so may not be as well captured, I believe, in the study trial data. And that weight loss then over time brings in fatigue. And at least in my experience, the limited number of cases that I've done the ADC, I have not necessarily seen that. So the EGFR side effects don't emerge. So what I would say is, yes, it is possible. If a patient is deriving clinical benefit from a TKI, I think it is possible to, with dose adjustments and antidiarrheals and skin sort of interventions, that we can allow the patient to stay on the drug. But I think there remains a very, very low grade level of toxicity that impacts overall quality of life.
I wanted to ask you about a couple other papers related to this issue of afatinib and also ERBB2 mutations. One, there was a paper by Peters et al. In the journal Thoracic Oncology, use of afatinib heavily pretreated patients with ERBB2 mutation positive advanced lung cancer, a global named patient use program. Any comments on what they looked at?
Right. So they looked at afatinib in sort of HER2 mutation positive lung cancer patients and found a response rate of approximately 19% or thereabouts. I think clearly afatinib works, but I think that if you look at HER2 mutation as a sort of one population, I think the benefit is limited. I don't think that that's surprising. I think if we looked at erlotinib or even osimertinib at EGFR mutations as one population, we will see that the benefit is primarily in 19 and 21. And I think that as we are gleaning more data from that study, there was a Japanese study and another study by Dzisko, a European study. The data is emerging that yes, there's benefit, but it is possible the type of HER2 mutation may determine the efficacy. And it appears this 775-776 deletion insertion, which is reasonably common, if I remember right, about 20-25% of HER2 mutations are that particular mutation, may be the most sensitive. And so I think we need to study this further to define what particular mutation the patient's tumor has and then assess efficacy. Up till now, what has been done is HER2 mutation positive lung cancer has been sort of enrolled on these trials and efficacy has been assessed. But I think we'll need to be a little more precise than that to truly assess the efficacy of these agents.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out the biology here. You know, there was this other paper in the European Journal of Cancer that looked at afatinib and again gets into the specific type of alteration that's seen. And a lot of these are exon 20. You were mentioning the new exon 20 drugs. Is that similar in terms of the location?
So the exon 20 drugs that we're talking about, like poziotinib and TAK-788, they are exon 20 mutations in the EGFR, whereas this is exon 20 in the HER2 gene.
Ah, okay.
So the exon 20 mutations in EGFR generally have been resistant to drugs like erlotinib and osimertinib because the pocket is very small, and so the drug can't, I'm simplifying this, but the pocket is very small, and so the drug can't, drugs like osimertinib and erlotinib. And so there are these tailored drugs, poziotinib and TAK-788, that can reach the pocket, ATP pocket in exon 20 mutations and have shown preclinical and clinical benefit. But interestingly, these drugs also appear to inhibit HER2 mutation positive lung cancers. And most of the HER2 mutations are in the exon 20 of HER2 gene.
Mm.
So even though it's exon 20, that's different than the exon 20 EGFR that we have been sort of talking about in the past. And these drugs have been looked at, again, very limited data, and they do appear to have efficacy probably a little bit better. So there's a drug called pirtobrutinib that has shown a response rate of about 55%, only 12 patients. Poziotinib has shown a confirmed response rate of about 42%, again, only 12 or 13 patients. So limited data, but maybe these drugs have a little bit better responses than the previous EGFR inhibitors such as afatinib.
So in a second, I want to talk about sort of new directions and also a little bit about the lung master protocol. But why don't we bring in another one of your patients? And you have an 82-year-old man. Can you talk about, I guess he presented, I guess it's now been about a year and a half ago, kind of how he presented?
So in sort of late summer of 2018, he was starting to have just very non-specific symptoms, some more cough, some more shortness of breath than what he was normally used to. Previous smoker, but was not actively smoking. Very frankly, went to seek medical sort of attention because of prompting by his wife. So on evaluation, was found to have basically stage 3 squamous cell lung cancer. And we treated him with weekly carboplatin and paclitaxel and radiation. So he received 6 weeks of therapy. And then after about a month, as is now routine based on the Pacific trial, we started him on durvalumab. So he started on durvalumab around January of 2019. And I tend to get scans approximately every 4 months once they start on the consolidation durvalumab. And so he was doing fine on the drug. He had recovered from the chemo radiation side effects. And in May of 2019, he was found to have liver metastases, about a couple of lesions. I decided to biopsy just to confirm his chest disease was under very good control. And these were the only two new areas. And so I just wanted to be certain, and it confirmed poorly differentiated squamous cell cancer. And so at that point, he had developed progression while on durvalumab. And so I started him on carboplatin paclitaxel. And as I'd mentioned before, I do the weekly paclitaxel with the carboplatin every 3 weeks. I will say that I have considered in some of these patients whether to use chemotherapy and pembrolizumab as I would in a treatment naive stage 4 lung cancer patient. We have absolutely no data for patients who have progressed. I decided to not do it in this particular patient because he had progressed relatively quickly within 5 months of having received durvalumab and chemotherapy and radiation. He had progressed, and I felt that putting him through chemotherapy and pembrolizumab may not be worth it.
Did he have either a PD-L1?
Yeah, PD-L1 was zero in this particular patient.
Did he have a tumor mutation burden level?
I did not get a tumor mutational burden. I'll admit to that. We did do an NGS panel locally, which does not report tumor mutational burden, and that showed a FGFR1 amplification, 9 copies. But I felt that he should be treated with platinum-based chemotherapy because he had not received sort of a full dose chemotherapy. And so I actually started him on carboplatin and paclitaxel. And he had some shrinkage of his liver metastases. By no means it was a RECIST-defined response. And we gave him 4 cycles. And at that point, he definitely developed fatigue. So in August, we discontinued. Unfortunately, in late October, he developed progression. And we are participating in the TAPER and MATCH trials. The TAPER trial is run by ASCO, and the MATCH is an NIH effort that is sort of tumor agnostic, but based on specific biomarkers, patients can be enrolled on sort of targeted treatments. And there is an FGFR alteration cohort in both TAPER and MATCH. And the drug that is being evaluated is actually a drug that now is approved for bladder cancer, which is adrafitinib, which inhibits all 4 FGFR receptors. And we did consider that trial. The patient was not interested. I see him at a satellite office. He really didn't want to come to the main center, was happy with just receiving, at that point, chemotherapy. So he got gemcitabine, but after 1 cycle was very exhausted. And at that point, he himself brought up the idea that he would like to just focus on comfort care and did not want to pursue further treatment. He felt he had a good life and so really was not interested in pursuing further treatment. I think at that point, if he was interested, I could have considered afatinib or reevaluated the possibility of enrolling him on the trial that would have enabled him to get the FGFR inhibitor to see if it is beneficial. One of the reasons I was a little reluctant about the FGFR trial is that the data we have up till now with other FGFR drugs is somewhat disappointing. So FGFR, in fact, recently in the LungMap study, there was a report by Dr. Agarwal and colleagues of an FGFR inhibitor, and the response rate was only about 5%, so only about 2 of some 35 patients or so had a response. And that is felt to be because even though FGFR may be a driver in these patients, these tumors are genomically so altered that they have other pathways that are also driving the tumor. And in fact, there's a very nice paper in Cancer Discovery by Paul Pike and colleagues from Memorial Sloan Kettering that showed that at least 20 to 25% of FGFR altered squamous cell lung cancer also have PI3 kinase alterations. And so it is possible that these tumors have an easier time, so to say, to, you know, if you block one pathway, immediately sort of switch their dependency to a different pathway or have an escape pathway that allows the tumor to start growing very, very quickly.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think the hope with these kind of basket trials is that things would sort of fall into place, I don't know, like MSI, where you're going to have one marker regardless of disease. Obviously, that doesn't always happen. BRAF's a good example. It works in lung and melanoma, but at least not the same approach with colon. You know, it's interesting how, you know, that model that you find an alteration and then you target it regardless of what the tumor doesn't always work out. We were doing a seminar on bladder cancer, then it sounds like they see really good responses there.
Yeah. So I think the tumor context matters with these alterations. I think the latest example is the G12C inhibitors, particularly AMG-510, shows very promising activity in non-small cell lung cancer with G12C inhibitor, but may not be the same activity in colon cancer with G12C inhibitor. I also wonder whether it has to do with the cause of that mutation occurring. So a KRAS mutation is very heavily linked to smoking history, particularly even among KRAS G12C, whereas, of course, in colon cancer, G12C mutation are not necessarily linked to smoking etiology. And so I wonder whether that plays a role. I think what is relevant, though, is like in BRAF V600E colon cancer, yes, the inhibiting the pathway helps, but maybe you have to add other molecules, as has been done recently with encorafenib and binimetinib with cetuximab, that when you add another pathway inhibitor to prevent the escape that may occur in certain tumor types but not in others, you will see benefit. So I think pursuing these strategies is going to be important, but I think the tumor context matters.
So let's finish out. You mentioned the Lung Master Protocol, and of course, Dr. Gandara, who wrote that editorial we're talking about before, was one of the leading forces in this, and the whole idea of trying to target squamous cell. You mentioned some of the other approaches, but we pulled out the Lung Cancer Master Protocol and several trials that came out, one that you already referred to. But can you talk a little bit about the way it was set up and executed?
So I think this was a phenomenal effort. And I think it required, particularly in squamous cell lung cancer, where the incidence is declining a bit, I think it required this effort by a cooperative group to get all the centers together and do the study. So very simply, this originally started with sort of doing on every patient NGS testing. And if specific genetic alterations were identified in patients who had previously been treated with platinum-based chemotherapy, they were randomized to either targeted therapy or docetaxel. Very quickly, they changed the study design, and I think rightly so, to make it where it was a single-arm study where they only got the genetically altered, because many of these patients had also been treated with second line. And I don't think that there was, at least in the initial exploratory phase, there was a need to do randomized study. And so the way the study was that if a promising activity was seen, then subsequently a randomized study could be done to truly assess the benefit. We have data on approximately three different. There is also immunotherapy data from that study. But as far as targeted therapy is concerned, there is data regarding sort of three specific agents. One is the FGFR inhibitor I mentioned, AZD4547. The other is a PI3 kinase inhibitor, and the third is a CDK4/6 inhibitor. So what's interesting is that the cyclin pathway, which I know oncologists are using CDK4/6 inhibitors in breast cancer patients now fairly routinely, but these cyclin pathways are significantly altered either because of loss of cyclin such as P16 that regulates cell cycle or upregulation of, say, cyclin D1 or cyclin 4 and 6 that sort of accelerates the cell cycle. And what they found, both with the CDK4 sitagliptin as well as the PI3 kinase inhibitor, that the responses were very limited. I think specifically with regards to the CDK4/6 inhibitor, it's not surprising that the response rate was low. These are mainly cytostatic agents. But I think even in breast cancer, they're commonly used in combination with hormonal agents. And so it is possible that if we combine it with other agents, maybe cytotoxic chemotherapy or other such agents, that we may see even better benefit. So I think what these studies have shown is that this is feasible, that you can enroll a lot of squamous cell lung cancer patients after their tumors have been genomically defined and assess the activity of these drugs. But I think they've also taught that the genomically, at least, these tumors are a lot more complex than, say, the EGFR and ALK and ROS1 tumors. And I think we'll have to be smarter and look at more combination treatments in the future, even if a specific target has been identified.
You know, it's funny, you're talking about these trials like the MAP study made me kind of think back to, I think it was called the Battle study. I think it was Roy Herbst did it at MD Anderson, a bunch of other people. And I don't remember how long ago it was. I don't think it was that long ago, but I just remember that it was so radical, that idea. You know, it was controversial, the idea of biopsying somebody who has metastatic disease and then tailoring the therapy. And they had it. I think in the beginning, there was a lot of resistance to the concept. And now it's like standard care.
Yeah. And in fact, now if you don't biopsy and get the molecular alterations, and frankly, now in EGFR and ALK patients, not only biopsy at diagnosis, but then subsequently to define the resistance pattern, and that might direct your treatment. So yes, we've come a long way. And of course, now we have blood-based tumor DNA analysis as well. So that makes it a little more easy. Though I will say that we should still do tumor analysis, because there are some limitations to blood-based analysis. And I think it helps when we get a result. But I think the simple thing to remember is, if the result is negative in a blood-based analysis, that does not mean a particular alteration doesn't exist in the tumor. And so the simple rule to follow is that if you identify an alteration, fine, you can act on it. But if you don't identify, don't forget to do a biopsy and get the tumor analyzed.
Well, there's also the issue of convenience, obviously, with a liquid biopsy, and also the fact that it's more current, you know. But if you do a liquid biopsy, for example, how likely is it that you'll pick up these sort of HER2 alterations or HERB alterations we're talking about?
So mutations, I think it is still possible, but I think what is the limitation with the blood-based, or many of the blood-based tests, and I think they are improving, is that it is hard to identify amplifications, it is hard to identify fusions in these. So there are certain limitations. Of course, not to mention, we are seeing, even now with immunotherapy, histologic switches. So we very well know about small cell transformation in EGFR and even sometimes in ALK. There are also reports of switch from adenocarcinoma to squamous cell carcinoma. And so in the right setting, even though you may have access to blood-based testing, I think there are certain advantages of doing tumor biopsies.
For sure. So let's finish out with maybe some hope for the future. And, you know, you were telling me about this 52-year-old patient with ALK. And, you know, maybe we'll get there someday with squamous cell. We'll have some kind of, you know, targeted therapy comparable to that. But investigators always have these incredible patients, and this patient seems like she's one of them. And rather than go through all the details, because I know she's doing great now, I'm just kind of curious what it was like when you first met her and what it's like to see her now.
So I will tell you, I just spoke with the husband for a completely non-medical reason. I guess I've become more friends with her, and I will be very candid that even now, whenever I think about her case, I don't know about emotional, but it makes me realize how human I am in terms of managing these patients. But very briefly, I will never forget the day I saw her, because I saw her the day before Thanksgiving in 2010. And this lady had clinical evidence of spinal cord compression after having had radiation, after she was diagnosed with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. We admitted her for immediate surgery, which she went very well, but unfortunately had complications one after the other. And she was quite religious, and because it was approaching Christmas, just wanted to go home. Because she was never a smoker at that point, now this is 2010, when we barely knew about ALK, and the only thing we knew was EGFR. We had treated her with erlotinib, but then her testing came back negative, so we stopped erlotinib, and she basically went home. The one thing that had happened, and I don't know whether this is relevant, is she had developed herpetic mucositis, and therefore she had swallowing difficulties. And so while she was admitted and before the decision of hospice was made, a feeding tube had been placed. So anyway, she goes to hospice, frankly, in December of 2010. And in March of 2011, I get a call from the husband. I had shared my cell phone with her because she was so sick. And he calls me in March. And I can tell you, to this day, I've asked him 2-3 times. He is not sure why he called me in March of 2011. He just called me just to let me know that she was doing well. And to be very frank, when I first took the call, I didn't remember her because I thought that she had passed away. So I said, I have this new trial that is testing for ALK in patients. And if they are positive, they are randomizing to a targeted therapy and chemotherapy. So she came to the clinic. She decided to come. She came, frankly, in a wheelchair on 2 liters of oxygen. And I can tell you there was a lot of resistance from my staff as exactly what I was doing, because this lady was in hospice and they thought I was subjecting her. And my only desire was I wanted to know if her tumor was ALK positive, because there was no other way other than putting her on the trial back then to get the tumor tested. So she agreed to sign the consent form, and we sent her spinal tumor that we had resected. We sent it for ALK testing, and it came back positive. And so I called them and I said, look, it's a randomized study, so she may get randomized to chemotherapy. And I'll tell you, when I think back, I think my role was very, very tiny. I think back of the patient's strength and sort of confidence in me in some way and in the system, because I think it is amazing. I think a lot of patients would have felt, you know, leave me alone, I'm doing okay. But she sort of came back, unfortunately had brain mets, so needed whole brain radiation, was of course randomized to chemotherapy, and then got chemotherapy for about 4-5 months, had some stability, but in February of 2012 had progression, and the study was a planned crossover to crizotinib. So she started on crizotinib.
I just got to backtrack a little bit. So this lady's in hospice. She and her husband are desperate to get the crizotinib, but she gets randomized to chemo even though she's in hospice. So
when she came to see me,
you took her off hospice.
She checked out of hospice.
So she checks out of hospice to go into the study. Gets randomized to chemotherapy, and she goes through the chemotherapy just to get to the crizotinib, I guess, right?
Yes.
And then she gets the
crizotinib.
Yes. Unbelievable. And then what happened?
Yes. And then I will say without any doubt that the best day as a thoracic oncologist in my life is in May of 2012. I got a picture sent by text of this patient of mine on an ATV, and I'm sure people know what an ATV is. And she was riding this ATV up a hill. I cannot describe to this day what I felt watching that picture, because this lady in December of 2010 was in hospice, and I was now almost a year and a half later, seeing a picture of this patient, you know, not on oxygen, nothing, just on an ATV riding up all by herself. So she did well and unfortunately started developing tumor progression in the brain and was on sorafenib for a period of time, didn't do very well on that. Mainly toxicity-wise, this disease was stable. And then in 2014, she was enrolled on the expanded access protocol of alectinib. And she's now 5 years out on alectinib with almost a CR. The brain mets have never progressed since. Unfortunately, she has now suffered consequences of the spine radiation that she developed. I suspect it is related to the spine radiation because she has developed a stricture in her esophagus. And so she needed reinsertion of her feeding tube.
Wow.
Because she developed a couple of different aspiration pneumonias. And my worry was that this stricture was malignant, but It was biopsied and it was non-malignant. They tried to dilate her, but they were very worried because this was a fibrotic stricture and the GI doctors were just a little concerned that they may have a perforation or something like that. And so she's on a G-tube now on alectinib, and I've been seeing her every 3 months. This is definitely an unusual case, but there are three things that sort of continuously I think about. One is, if this patient had been diagnosed even 6 or 8 months before she was, I don't think she would have had a chance to go on Profile 1014 trial and had this outcome. And for that matter, it was only in 2007 the first report of ALK translocation was published in Science by the Japanese investigators. And so there have been a lot of events in her life that have sort of by chance helped her to live this long. And I can tell you, I don't think I'm a religious person, but I don't know, I've developed a lot of faith because of this particular patient. And I think that that helps me take care of these patients. But yeah, I don't like to discuss this case because of the good outcome. A lot of patients have good outcome, but just the sequence of events of, you know, being in hospice, being on oxygen and in a wheelchair to come to a point. And I also feel that so many different people in the world helped her. I mean, if ALK was not identified by investigators in Japan, if crizotinib had not been developed, when the investigators in Boston had not developed an ALK test, so on and so forth. I mean, the number of people that have helped her live these 9 years, 10 years is just tremendous. So this is the reason I think I'm so glad that I did choose thoracic oncology when 20 years ago, the pulmonologist I worked with was kind of, in a very concerned way, wondering why I was going into thoracic oncology.
Can you imagine walking into your clinic and the entire waiting room is filled with people like her? I mean, that becomes oncology, but, you know, who knows? We'll see.
I will say one last thing is, what has it been interesting with her case and now some other cases who have received immunotherapy and target therapy is you have to convince other specialties. You have to advocate for your patient because the first impression by the other is, what are you doing? You know, this patient has stage 4 lung cancer. And so as an oncologist, you have to advocate for your patient. Say, yes, the patient has stage 4 lung cancer. And yes, the cancer may kill her any time, but she's done well. And I think we should maybe look at her a little differently than what we would, you know, normally to a lung cancer patient.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Gajeel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special iJournal Club audio program on the management of squamous cell carcinoma of the lung.